Is our president a good political communicator?
I think he understands some things very well. One of the things that he understands very well is that, you know, scattered attention mindset. What do you do to break through? Being willing to be a bomb thrower is something that, you know, that works. There's got to be a point of diminishing returns. But for a long time, it works.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I enjoyed talking to Christy Setzer. Christy is the president and founder of New Heights Communications, a Washington, D.C.-based communications firm that works with mission-driven clients. Christy has more than 20 years' experience in national politics. She started New Heights in 2010 after more than a decade working on campaigns and progressive causes. She served as national spokesperson on the presidential campaigns of Vice President Al Gore, former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, and Senator Christopher Dodd. She also set national communication strategy and did media relations for the AFL-CIO, Planned Parenthood, and the SEIU. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Christy Setzer of New Heights Communications.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, Christy. Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Christy Setzer. I am currently the president of New Heights Communications, which is a company that I founded in 2010 after, a decade and a half of working in politics, on political campaigns, and in progressive advocacy spaces.
One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is that you have been in the communications part of campaigns, and that's not a part that I know well. I've been in the technology part of campaigns. What was your path into politics?
It's a little unusual that I was interested in politics from somewhat of a young age. The first time I remember being interested was during the 1992 Democratic primary, at which point I was still in high school. For some reason, and again, I can't remember why, but Tsongas made an impression. And so by the time I was applying to colleges, I remember thinking a little bit about that maybe I would someday want to go into local politics, which, by the way, I no longer really do. But so that interest bubbled up even more in college. I ran our college Democrats group, got involved in a bunch of other little groups like that. I'd interned for my hometown representative, who was a Republican, by the way. And so did the interning on the Hill thing. And then was one of those people that, 5 days after college graduation, came down to D.C., no job, but just, door knocking until I finally found one. Again, it's sort of hard to pinpoint what it was about it. There wasn't anybody in my family who was particularly interested in politics. I think I grew up outside of Philadelphia, where Montgomery County and the rings around Philadelphia are now pretty reliably Democratic, but at the time they were actually pretty reliably Republican. My mother will tell the story that my father convinced her to register as a Republican because he said, it's the only way you're going to make any kind of an impact here is by seeing, who gets nominated in the primary.
And you went to Vassar, right? What did you study there?
I did. I was a political science major after considering things like being an English major or, American cultures. But I was a poli-sci major.
Yeah. So you came to D.C. and you were door knocking. What was that first job that you were able to land?
So my very first job was with Joe Slade White and Company. Now, they were a small political advertising firm. They definitely are still out there and doing good work.
I've interviewed Joe. He's quite a character.
He's amazing. Yeah. He has phenomenal stories. And so that was a really fabulous introduction to politics. Even before that, I interned on the Hill again that summer on the Rules Committee. But anyway, so that first job was a sort of a communications-oriented job. And Joe pretty much wrote the ads himself. Largely what my job was I was the client coordinator, the one that would say to our campaigns, okay, we just did your first ad, it was on education. We said that the next one on the flight is going to be on healthcare. Does that still work for you?
Sort of project management.
Sort of was more, exactly, yeah. Right.
Well, what did you learn from Joe? He seemed to be ensconced in a rural area and sort of comes out to do politics.
there was a bit of a mythology around Joe, both because he was in Buffalo and obviously the rest of us were in D.C. He had cultivated a bit of a mad genius persona to him. And he was a very nice guy, by the way, and continues to be a very nice guy. But part of the mad genius thing was that he was able to, write these brilliant ads when the moment struck.
Well, it's there is an art to making political communications, isn't there? After all these years in politics, what is your own theory about what makes successful political communication?
I would say two things. One, which we all talk about these days, which is authenticity. It's cliche to talk about Ocasio-Cortez, her Instagram cooking. But again, the reason that people connect is because it does feel real, even in sort of her ads and, running for Congress, where she's talking about how she's, kind of running in heels but doing this thing. There were different ways in which it felt like she was bringing, in writing they talk about how you want to, bring all of the pieces to the table, right? Not just sort of a very narrow focus part of the story. And it felt like she and others who are successful are able to do that. So one, I would say, of course, just the, authenticity piece, which, by the way, is a lot easier for women today in 2019 than it was at any point in the past. The other part that I would say is having an understanding of where the momentum is, where the sort of, national meta-narrative is playing out. That plays out in communications quite a bit. It's a lot easier to figure out how a client or a part of a story fits into a narrative that is already set and to pitch the story that way than it is to try to set a new narrative.
It's actually something that drives me crazy about the way the press reports. If they have a story going, then they load lots of more things on after it. You get something like the email story with Clinton that just won't die because it's a story. Does that make sense, the way it's covered?
So, of course it doesn't. And yet it does, because we're all human and because we organize our thoughts around storytelling. And it's very, very difficult to break a narrative that has already become pretty entrenched in your head. And so as a communications professional, there are certainly times where you want to say it's counterintuitive, but here's something that actually works against the grain. There's a lot more times, I would say, where, again, the easiest way is to sort of meet people where they are, understand what their narrative and ways of thinking already are, and then maybe pivot a little bit. I mean, it's even something I'd say that it depends, but in sometimes, in the sort of less contentious, let's say Fox News interviews that I'll do, that's the idea, is to, first meet people where they are and then say, but actually it's a little bit different than that because X, Y, Z.
So I see when I look at your resume that you were Iowa press secretary for Gore. What's the route from Joe Slade White to that position?
There was one intermediary step, which was that I worked for a company, QRS News Media, and they were doing all the satellite media for the Gore campaign, which they had done for the Clinton campaign in 92 and 96, campaigns that had used satellite media quite a lot. The Gore campaign used it less, but we were the main people who, at the very, very early stages after the announcement, after Gore's announcement, were the ones who would, you know, kind of be in the control room saying, you know, okay, sir, next you're going to be talking to Dave Price at WHO-TV in Des Moines, which, by the way, is a real person. And you're going to have about 5 minutes. I'll give you a countdown and you've got 1 minute left, you know, doing that sort of thing.
So is there a connection through Laura Quinn in that world?
Indeed, yes. She started it, was one of the partners. Because of that work, I knew what was going on with the campaign pretty intimately at the time. They had just one person who was their communications director on the Iowa campaign. He was, you know, a one-man band. So by the time we got to 2 months before the caucuses, they were looking for a press secretary to add to the shop. So despite the fact that I was 23 or whatever I was able to get in there.
One of the amazing things about politics, I think, mm-hmm. is how young people can be incorporated into important positions.
I mean, it was an amazing, amazing experience because there was that weird hybrid where I was super young, but in basically a pretty senior position. And so that was recognized in different ways, which was they had a 7 a.m. senior staff meeting. I was part of that senior staff meeting, but I also did the press clips before the senior staff meeting, right? So I would get there at, you know, 6 or 6:30 and, you know, and flag the top news stories for the day and, you know, report out on them. And so that was the way in which, you know, people got that I was 23. And of course, there were a lot of really young people on the campaign, but also were able to afford some.
And that was the big face-off between Gore and Bradley, right?
Yeah.
And how were you thinking about that yourself, like, at the time?
How
did you see that?
It was, I would say, my first real awakening into politics and into narrative building and breaking. And the story that I'll tell is that we had been, as the Iowa Gore campaign, hounding Bill Bradley over this vote that he had taken in the Senate against providing extra funding for people who had been affected by this flood and people in Iowa who'd really been affected by it. And Bradley had defended the vote and essentially said at one point, you know, look, I represent New Jersey, you know, right? I mean, it was more or less honest about why he had voted against it. But that really wasn't okay, obviously, if you were in Iowa. So anyway, we did a number of things to, you know, to call attention to that, which is all fair. Did things like we had this mascot character that would follow him around say that, you know, Bill Bradley was afraid to debate. It was Corn Man. It was Iowa Corn Man. So it was a 6-foot stalk of corn. He was, quote, stalking Bill Bradley, uh-huh. telling him that he needed him to debate. Ha ha, right? Anyway, so we get to the actual, you know, debate, and you get a certain number of, you know, tickets for the campaign, and we had given them to, instead, not to, you know, the campaign's consultants and that sort of thing, but we'd given them to 10, let's say, real people who could stand up and tell real people stories about how Bill Bradley had hurt them. And essentially, I realized in this that I was like, we know that what we're saying right now isn't entirely true, or it isn't entirely fair. And it was awakening to me. It was an awakening to me of, like, why are we doing that? Like, we're not being totally intellectually honest in how we're presenting this argument. And it was surprising.
I have a hard time with primaries, particularly mm-hmm. for that reason, because you watch, I mean, I like both Gore and Bradley personally. I think mm-hmm. they were both good senators and would have been happy with either of them as a president.
Right. and the alternative, right.
Yes.
Yeah.
and to see a lot of times politics devolve into something that's a cudgel for some reason based on consultants, it seems like, rather than some kind of higher minded way of thinking about the differences mm-hmm. I think it's real. It's the way it happens. And that's by far not the lowest that politics descends. That example is gentle, right?
That was a completely gentle example. Right. And you know,
but it is the way, we fight a lot of things, isn't it?
Yeah. And sometimes, by the way, the things that, you know, the candidates are being tagged with the media, there's a there's
sometimes
a reason.
Sometimes they're really good choices, right? Sometimes the cudgel makes sense.
Yeah.
And really indicates a substantive difference between two different people.
That's right. I mean, but what's interesting and sort of, again, the luxury that we had in, you know, in 1999 between two, again, very, very competent and, you know, candidates was that the differences that came to the fore were really much more about personality and about, you know, that Gore was standoffish and perhaps elitist, which, again, also ended up being tagged against Bill Bradley as well. Like, there was, like, this terrible photo in the New York Times in which, so after Iowa, I went to Seattle. I was the communications director for the Washington State campaign there, which after, you know, Bradley lost Iowa, whatever, Washington State was then seen as the place where he could really maybe get back his momentum and stay in the game. He ended up losing there as well. But maybe one of the things that really kind of put the nail in the coffin was there was this New York Times photo of him in which he was on the subway. Was he in the subway in New York?
Is this Bradley that we're talking about?
Yeah. It might have been. I think he was in the subway in New York. But and instead of doing the whole thing where you're, you know, glad handling and there's a million people coming up to you, he was standing all alone. And, you know, and it was, of course, bad staff work to have that photo be able to be taken. But it also, you know, again, it helped this pre-existing narrative about him as just being somebody who's sort of standoffish and aloof, et cetera.
And was probably chosen by the press
because
to make that point,
of
right?
that point.
And he could have taken a picture probably of him smiling at somebody just as well.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Of course. Right. Yeah.
Although
yes.
He was a kind of, I mean, he was a kind of an intellectual, even though he was a basketball player. He was,
right.
He was someone who wanted to think and do policy maybe more than stand on the rope line.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Right. So, right. Exactly. The choices that they were making were ones that, you know, took that narrative that probably they were the ones who had helped set and then, you know, snowballed them into something that, like, as a voter, you can't really ignore.
So you are kind of experiencing firsthand this tension between idealism and what actually happens, mm-hmm. right? But you also are getting the bug, it seems like, for political communications, because that's where your career continues to this day, right? What was it?
Yeah.
What was sucking you into this as something to be spending your life on?
The pace, for one thing. I mean, it's, you know, someone said to me after the campaign was over, it's really hard to go from that, you know, 24/7, like, need it yesterday pace to getting into a, quote, real job where someone can say to you, well, it's important, but you can do it tomorrow. Why can't I do more? Yeah.
So I know that you made it to National Press Secretary for Dodd, but that's basically 7 years later than the Gore campaign.
Yeah.
What were you doing in between?
There were a lot of campaigns. There was some advocacy work. So I had kind of alternated. So in 2001, I worked at NARAL and their communications shop. In 2002, I was the communications director up in Maine for their state Democratic Party and for the coordinated campaign there. That was actually a race of Shelley Pingree versus Susan Collins.
I remember we had hopes for that one.
We sure did. I mean, Shelley Pingree was an amazing, amazing candidate. But the national momentum there in 2002, just it, you know, it's like, that's, I think, the first time that you sort of learn that, like, the dominoes all seem to fall one way. It's not like, I mean, there's always this, again, this, in national punditry, you know, I feel like we always want to sort of split the difference and say, well, you know, it could go either all this way to the left or could go all the way to the right. So it's probably somewhere in the middle. It's probably like maybe the, you know, Senate picks up a seat or two and whatever. That's not usually the case. They're usually wave elections, or at least in the last, 12 years or so, been the case.
When the two parties are fairly evenly divided, a little bit of national wind mm-hmm. blows a lot of people in one direction.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So that was all of 2002. I came back and dipped my toe into journalism a bit. I was at nationaljournal.com. So I wrote like their early morning roundup, early bird. That was great, except for the fact that we had to be there by, you know, 6 or 6:30 in the morning,
which, that is early, yeah.
Which was tough. Had briefly considered going to journalism school, applied, actually got in, but then decided that I just, again, really liked what I was doing too much. So that by the time I would have actually had to go to journalism school, which was 2004. It was during a, you know, brief shining moment in John Kerry's campaign in which it was actually going well, and we knew he was going to win. We knew he was going to be the next president. It was absolutely going to happen. So
it's painful to go over recent political history sometimes.
Right.
What were you working with the Kerry campaign?
I worked with America Coming Together. So I was one of the regional communications desks. So I oversaw seven or something of the, you know, the target states.
That's sort of the national field campaign of that year.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Worked with the communications directors in, we'd basically identified, I think it was 17 or 18, you know, battleground states. I ended up overseeing about half of them. And then, you know, yeah, worked with them to put together that day's events, to push back on.
So get me all the way up to the Dodd campaign. What was next?
So this is the point in which, you know, maybe up to this point too, but in my resume in which, you know, I start changing jobs every 6 months or so. It's like where that campaign pace like catches up to you because, again, every real job feels boring.
Well, people seem to either burn out of politics doing campaign one mm-hmm. after another and move to something more stable, or just make a life of it at this point in their career.
Yeah, I mean, and again, when I sort of looked, so there were several years where I actually felt, I think, pretty deep shame about the fact that I kept job switching, that I had this just kind of itch to keep moving on and get, you know, and doing different and more political things. But it ended up, and I know we'll get there, but, you know, serving me well once I started my business, because as it turns out, I knew a lot of people. I hadn't burned that many bridges. I, you know, for the most part, people liked me. It was okay. But it's something that, you know, makes, that really sets apart, I think, the people that consider themselves kind of just political in nature, and by which the campaign speed and churn is something that you kind of thrive in from the rest of the world.
It's addicts is what it is.
It's addiction. Yeah.
So talk to me about the role with Dodd, and how was that? It was not a winning campaign.
It was definitely not a winning campaign. Yeah. I will back up a little bit. It was probably the first time in my life where I was able to see a few years down the road and set a path for myself that I knew would set me up well. So in 05, 06, after I had done the New York City mayor's race, I was Freddie Ferrer's press secretary against Bloomberg. That was actually, by the way, the first time in which most, quote, people like me, my friends and others that I knew, favored the Republican. there were plenty of people who, you know, who
it
were
wasn't
behind
exactly
Bloomberg.
Republican.
Well, yeah. Right, and that's how, obviously, you know, it was sort of justified. And anyway, so we did that campaign. You know,
and
we
spent
always
$80 million, so a lot of people wanted to be part of that.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's, you know, still people that I work with in Democratic politics who were on that campaign and who made very good, you know, Democratic careers after having worked for the Republican. But anyway, but I didn't. I had, you know, I'd worked for Freddie, and and that was a tough campaign. We always sort of knew that we were gonna, or we hoped that we would win the primary, but then we're pretty sure that we were gonna lose the general, which we did resoundingly. So shortly after I got back from New Yorker, I had taken on a position as the communications director for a group called Senate Majority Project. And the idea behind that was, look, there's lots of people and groups that are set up to look at the Republicans who are up this cycle, who would be up in, you know, November or the next year. But the reason why, one of the reasons why Republicans have been incredibly successful at sort of rigging the game, especially when you look at things like gerrymandering, whatever, is that they had the ability to look, you know, several years out and several years down the road in a way that we just never did. I had also worked on the 2000 Democratic Convention, and there was a reporter there who said to me, you know, when you cover these campaigns long enough, she said, it shows the differences, really, the way that they run their conventions shows the differences between the parties. She said, which is that the Republican conventions, I'm sure this is not the case with the Trump convention, but she said, have this, you know, precision to them. They have this, like, almost, she's like, this hierarchical, almost, you know, German way of getting everything done. She said, the Democratic conventions are always incredibly messy and chaotic, but at the end, somehow it all comes together. Anyway, so back to Senate Majority Project. So the idea was that we would look at Republicans who were up in 2008, 2010, just down the road and start sort of softening them up and getting the narrative out there about people that no one was really thinking about because they're not in cycle. And the reason that I took that job, in addition to the fact that it was, you know, interesting to me and a good job and a good team, was because that I knew it would sort of set me up well in the next cycle to either be the communications director for something like the DSCC or to go over to a presidential campaign and hopefully be national press secretary. So in the end, that's exactly what happened. You know, after that, I interviewed with a bunch of the Democrats who were running in 08, got this offer from the Dodd campaign, was definitely in the mix and kind of waiting to hear back from a couple others, but bird in the hand and all. So I went over to be their national press secretary and learned, I'd say the biggest learning lesson there was that certain people who'd been with the senator a long time, I think were not steeped in presidential politics and did not seem to really grasp the difference between, you know, running for a Senate reelection in a safe Democratic seat versus just the rigors of a presidential campaign.
Did you find yourself on that campaign wishing you had more power to shape how he was campaigning?
Sure. I mean, the one thing that...
He didn't break through.
He absolutely didn't break through.
Right. And of course, he was up against some very skilled politicians, including Obama.
Correct. And to the extent that he did in any way break through, which was a bit with, you know, an affinity for the Net Roots, that was by virtue of the fact that we had a really talented digital team that did actually, I think, have a good grasp of how, if he was going to break through, how it was going to happen, right? I mean, but again, I think the thing that, and I don't want to, you know, speak ill of anybody necessarily, like, on the campaign, but the difference, of course, between doing what he had been doing for so many years as a, you know, beloved senator, who, by the way, like every hometown state poll, you know, usually says, no, we don't want our person to actually run for president. And that was the you know, the case in Connecticut as well. They didn't, you know, necessarily, they were not feeling Dodd-mentum. Is, I think that people don't understand how regular voters shorthand who a candidate is, especially in a really crowded field. So when, you know, I and others would sort of raise the question of, well, what is basically the voter shorthand for this guy? What are like the two or three words or the one image or whatever, you know, that we want him to associate with him? And by that, I mean, in 2008, it was like, Obama's the black guy, Hillary's the woman. I mean, you know, like really crude, like kind of just, you know, and so if we don't do it, it's going to be, you know, you're the old white guy. Oh, wait, Joe Biden's in there too. You're going to be the other old white guy. Right. So
so have something else to be your one of your three words or something.
Right.
We have a triply more crowded field coming up in 2020. What advice would you give if you had the chance to people working at the high echelons of those campaigns to try to successfully communicate and break out?
Yeah, exactly that. Punch one message. You're going to have others. You're going to have the opportunity to answer a lot of different things. But understand what the easiest lane is for you to play in, the one that people are naturally going to associate. And if you want something totally different than that, then just understand how difficult that's going to be. I mean, you know, in 2004, John Kerry may have wanted to be, and I'm not saying he did, he didn't, but, you know, wanted to be, like, let's say, the education president. But no, he was going against, you know, George Bush, who at that time considered himself, you know, a wartime president. So he was going to have to run on national security. There wasn't another option open to him. He had to be, you know, running on that certain set of issues. You know, look, if Kirsten Gillibrand wants to, you know, lean on the stuff that she did with military sexual assault and, you know, into a broader thing about Me Too and, you know, and even, you know, Franken to some extent, right? Then that's fine. That's an easy narrative for her to make. It's going to be much harder, I think, if she wants, and she can use that to pivot into kind of similar-ish issues. But it's going to be a lot harder if she wants to do something decidedly different than that. It's just, you know, again, to go back to my point of like, get where the narrative is, get where the sort of energy and momentum is for that narrative, and then either figure out how to slightly pivot, but it's just going to be too discordant for people if you try to do something decidedly different.
So given that kind of communications lens, when you look at some of the top candidates, who do you think is sort of already pigeonholed in a useful place, like in a place that's going to really serve them in their candidacy?
Yeah. Well, I think that the narrative coming out of 2018 was that all the energy was with women and people of color in the Democratic Party. So, and that particularly that we take black women for granted again and again and again. So Kamala Harris, you know, in that way. Also, the sort of, you know, the way that she positioned herself out of the Kavanaugh hearings, which was take no crap, tough, smart, you know, and could stand up to Kavanaugh, and by virtue of that can stand up to Trump. I think that's helpful. Same thing with, I'd say, Elizabeth Warren, in that it's just clear the way that she gets under Trump's skin, and obviously all the work that she does against Wall Street, et cetera, is a nice contrast with the president. So I think those two people take the pigeonhole and
it serves them.
And it serves them quite well.
Who do you think is in a less favorable position by virtue of how, you know, we think about them in shorthand?
So unfortunately, I'd say Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. Joe Biden, I think, will end up, and again, I say this with all the love in the world for Joe Biden, sincerely, potentially being, or at least there's a danger of him being the John Kasich of the Democratic primary field, which is to say every, you know, never Trump or Republican that you know probably would say, I would love for Joe Biden to run. He's serious. He's, you know, the real deal. He would never embarrass us on the national stage, you know, all those things. And that's true. But the narrative that he is fighting is that he's too old. Again, he's the past. He's the white guy when all the energy is behind women and people of color. I mean, so there's a lot of like essentialist reasons why I think that's tough. But it's also always the case, almost always the case, that Democrats go with somebody who is new and exciting versus somebody that, like, you know, had run before and didn't catch on.
I don't know. We went for Walter Mondale, but
yeah. Yeah, right. I mean, I guess, like, again, like, my lens on this is from the 90s, board, yeah. Right? But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Sanders has the advantage of having defined himself quite a bit, but he's not the new guy this time again. And right. He is a white male and an old white male.
Yeah, and I think that's tough. I mean, he comes with a base of support. But if you're somebody that wasn't necessarily behind him last time, why would you be this time?
Yeah. So you spent 6 months on the Chris Dodd campaign. What did you do after that?
Yeah, so this is the part of my resume that gets choppy. For a while there, I worked for Planned Parenthood. And then I finished that cycle with the strategy group. And I did direct mail for some congressional candidates, for a couple different state legislative caucuses.
And that's a big political consulting firm, right?
Yeah.
Does it with a kind of a broad range of services nowadays anyway.
Maybe. I mean, when I was doing it, the heart of it really was direct mail, which is really different for a comms person like myself because the... because you're thinking visually as opposed to thinking in words. And, you know, basically people look at a piece of direct mail for a couple of seconds. So you really get the chance to just punch one, not just one message, like one image. So it's just, again, it's a different way of using your brain, which I wasn't a natural for necessarily, but was a good thing to do.
So you were national media director for the SEIU. What was your experience at SEIU like?
So I loved SEIU because I felt that they were the most creative and willing to try new things of other labor unions that I had experienced. I think that in general, the problem with labor unions can be that we're very good at talking to the, 5 to 7% of the population that's actually part of a union, and pretty bad at talking to the 90+% of the population that's not. And I thought that SEIU brought with it a lens that kind of said, yeah, I mean, we're talking to people in the labor union, in, you know, that are directly at SEIU or in labor unions in general, but really we're saying this to everybody, you know, and the sort of fight for a fair economy and those concepts, right, came out of, you know, the idea that, you know, you can't just be so narrowly focused. We have to be talking about why these are good for everybody.
What does a national media director do there?
The main things that we were working on when I was there were two things. One, national, the Affordable Care Act and, you know, communications around that and lifting up the stories of real people and, you know, obviously lobbying on the Hill and with the administration to help them get it done. And then the Employee Free Choice Act, which basically would have eased the path for people to form a union in their workplace. And it became pretty clear that even though this was very important to SEIU and others in the labor movement, that some tough choices were going to be made and that we were going to first put our efforts into healthcare and, you know, and glad we did and all that. So, but those are the two things. As national media director, what I would try to do is, you know, we would have a morning meeting of all the people who were leading these different campaigns and what was going on in their world that day, you know, sort of go around the horn and, you know, and then we'd have a bit of a brainstorming session about, you know, places where we could sort of connect to create sort of a larger narrative about what was going on in the labor union that day. And, you know, where we could be helpful and what was in the news that, you know, might spark something else.
For someone who's considering a career in political communications, when you had reached this point, like, what do you think was the right kind of choices that you had made? And what do you think might have been the less optimal choices if there were any?
So when I worked in that first job at Joe Slade White, there was someone there who had said to me as a piece of advice, look, like, you don't need to, this isn't going to be like the last job you're ever going to have in your life. Like, you know, you can do TV and radio ad making for a while, and you could work on the Hill for a while, and you can work at a PR firm for a while. And he said, you know, in some ways I kind of think about it as like taking college courses, right? Like you're going to take a class in pollster, you know, being an pollster or a class and whatever. And that all together, you know, gives you a broader picture of the way this stuff all works. You know, when I look back, as I said, you know, I feel like I took a lot of classes, but it made me a better rounded communications professional, understanding how that all that works.
It seems to me like you have an unusually broad set of experiences for starting a firm in that area. What's the founding story for New Heights Communications?
I lived in Columbia Heights. So New Heights is a bit of a play on that. That is the name. The founding story, I mean, I think that there's some gendered reasons behind when women versus men tend to start firms like this. I think typically, again, I'm speaking incredibly generally, but a lot of times when men do it, it's the idea that, you know, we have this great idea, we're gonna go out, we're gonna, you know, run the world, we're gonna make a lot of money, we're gonna do all the things that...
We're gonna grow an empire.
We're gonna grow an empire, yes. I tend to think that for women, usually it sort of just starts with a bit of a dissatisfaction with their current job and feeling like maybe they're not being totally used in the right way. And that was the case. I mean, I think that by the time I was in my late 20s, you know, I started seeing guys who had exactly the same experience as me get tapped for much bigger things, and somehow a lot of the women who were my peers who also had exactly the same experience were not somehow getting tapped for bigger things. And, you know, and then by kind of your early 30s or so with me, I knew what I could do. And I knew, you know, that I wasn't necessarily being, as I said, you know, kind of used in the right way. So it didn't start as the idea that I would start a firm. It started just as, well, let's just pick up a couple projects until I figure out what the next thing is. But
you named it. Right?
Right.
And you incorporate it?
Immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah. I approached it totally differently.
But that's sort of saying I'm creating a business, right?
It was.
Maybe you didn't want to acknowledge it fully to yourself or something.
What I had done was I went to my bosses at SEIU and I said, here's what I'm thinking about. I basically started with you guys as a consultant. I think I would like to go back to being a consultant. I'd like to work on X, Y, and Z. Would you be open to that? And frankly, to my surprise, they said, sure.
Was that because they could get like a fractional amount of you? I mean, sometimes that's one of the strategic moves to move back to being a consultant, to say, look, you got me full time. You can get a lot of me for half price or something like that.
I don't know. I think so. I mean, but so I had some buy-in, and then the world changed over there, which was that, you know, Andy Stern, who'd been the president for a number of years, stepped down. The woman who was supposed to be the sort of obvious successor, Anna Berger, ended up not becoming the president of the union. It was someone else. And so a lot of things changed. And in the end, I said, you know what, I'm actually still going to leave. It's okay.
And you didn't end up with him as a client?
Well, I did, but not immediately. Okay. Not until a year later, actually. I said, you know, I'm still going to leave. But I'd given a month's notice. And in that time, I basically went to friends and sort of said, the people who were kind of the lowest hanging fruit, where I thought, you know, there was one organization, for example, that I had basically been giving them free advice for a long time, and said, do you think that there would be any interest if I were to do some media relations for you guys, whatever. And, you know, and again, and I thought about it differently that time. I said, I could give you maybe this many hours, or we don't really do hourlies anymore. But at the time, you know, I could give you this many hours, like you could pay me this much a month. Would you be into that? And then once I got that, then another, you know, friend had told me about something else. It was a campaign that was looking for a comms person. Not a political campaign, sort of an advocacy campaign, and was looking for a communications consultant.
Typical problem for people starting out like that is the difficulty of asking for money for something that maybe you've been providing for free to a friend or while you had a job, and how much to ask. How did you sort through that?
We'd hired a lot of consultants at SEIU, so I kind of understood what a going rate was. And frankly, I think I was probably more comfortable asking for more than I would have otherwise been comfortable
because
asking for.
Because you've been on the other side of the table.
Because I knew.
That's a great experience to have.
So that was why. So with those two clients, I, you know, was making the same amount that I'd made at SEIU. And that was a good enough starting point to be like, hey, this could be a thing.
Pretty exciting.
It was exciting.
Yeah. Did you start hiring at some point?
About a year in. So when I first started it and realized, again, that this could be my thing, I didn't actually have to go back to a, quote, real job, which was enormously liberating. There's just a difference in the relationship you have to the work, and certainly to the people who are giving you the work when you're consulting versus when you're in a job. And it's just... I find it to be a ton more empowering, because you are the one, instead of, you know, them saying, okay, the job is, we will pay you this much, you will do these things, you will, you know, ask permission if you need to go to a dentist appointment or whatever, right? Like, you are the one who is saying, I, you know, charge this much, I'm available basically at these times, or...
You're a professional.
You know, right. So I'd started in May, and then that was 2010, and so that was... it was a midterm election year. And so by the fall, friends of mine who did more, you know, expressly political things were coming to me for, in addition to the couple of clients that I already had, you know, could I be a spokesperson for this particular PAC? Could I, you know, do things that were more like that?
So in general, what were people paying you to do, like specifically?
Yeah. For the most part, media relations at that point. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was...
Well, what does that mean, media relations?
Oh, I have an organization. I have a project. I want to get them in, I want to get some press attention for it. I think that we want to tell a story.
Is that pitching stories? Is that what essentially is?
It is. It's coming up with what's interesting and new about this organization that a lot of times, to go back to the common theme of this conversation, that fits into an existing narrative that people may want to tell. And can I get people to write about it or put our spokespeople on TV? Or, you know, can we change an existing storyline? So my first client was an organization that actually came out of the labor coalition Change to Win. And it was called U.S. Chamber Watch. And the idea was, which started, again, initially as a project and then became its own organization. The idea was that most people think of, who are not involved in, let's say, Democratic or progressive politics, think of the U.S. Chamber as something like, you know, your local chamber, a representation of the, you know, local mom and pop stores in your city or town, and pretty politically neutral, probably. Like, they just care about good business, right? So the idea of U.S. Chamber Watch was to say, no, for all intents and purposes, they're an arm of the Republican Party. They are also using the organizations that, you know, like Walmart, et cetera, you know, these big businesses to have enormous political sway. And here's some of the things that they've done. You probably don't like it. It's very different than your local mom and pop. So the way that we did that was, again, you sort of recognize the imbalance of power there, which is that, like, we're a tiny little group. The U.S. Chamber gets press all of the time, every day. So really, and there was nobody who was kind of punching up and, like, poking a hole in the story that they were telling. So we got a lot of good press just by poking holes in the things that they were doing. And
kind of tagging on to their press.
We absolutely tagged on to their press. And the only thing that they really could, because the things that we were saying were true and not terribly unfair. You know, sometimes we'd publish reports about the stuff that they were doing. That would get some press attention. And again, we got this, like, outsized amount of interest just based on the fact that they had an outsized amount of interest. So they would punch down sometimes and say, well, this is a labor union backed group and whatever. And we'd say, true, but what we said isn't wrong. You know, so, okay.
In all these years where you were doing media relations or things related to it, how was it changing in how receptive the press was and how many different organs of the press are available to talk to and the different modes of communicating with them? What is the change that's going on?
Yeah, so in 20 years of doing this, it has changed enormously. The typical event in, you know, 1999 or so was done by writing a press advisory that you then faxed to every TV station that said at the top, attention assignment editor. Like, you know, and you faxed it again, then you'd call to say, did you get the fax? They would say, no, we didn't see it. So then you'd fax it again, you know. And if you were talking to print reporters, that was a phone call. I mean, yeah, I think, you know, you'd email as well. But, you know, but for the most part, if you wanted to get anything done, it was a phone call. You know, to today, where it's harder and harder because, I mean, you see that the way that the world is changing. I mean, journalists have so much on their plates, and they're not lazy, as is the narrative out there. They're not necessarily biased, which is the other narrative out there. They just have a lot more competing pressures than they ever did before, and the story that they're writing is not the only story that they're going to write that day, and they're not just going to put it up, you know, they're not just going to give it to their editor, they're going to then do a podcast about it, then they're going to, you know, they just have a lot more things.
Tweet it, they're going to, yes.
Right. So there are some who still prefer to be, you know, contacted by phone, and if you have a good relationship, that's the way to go, and truth be told, and especially out in the States as opposed to here in D.C. or in New York, they're a lot more receptive to getting phone calls. But the difference is that a lot of the communication has been mediated to, you know, to email, and the way that you know that they're not interested is they don't respond. And what's lost there, of course, is the little things that you would pick up in a 5-minute conversation with you as opposed to an email exchange. Like, you're going to give me all kinds of information, both, you know, in what you say and don't say and the way you say it, that I'll never get from an email. So it becomes tougher for people like me to get a legitimate story out there that a reporter would probably want, just by the fact that it's much harder to reach them. They have more things to do. We have more things to do, you know?
If you look sort of at the battlefield between the two parties,
yeah,
and how the forces are mobilized through communications, do you think there's an advantage that one side has over the other? Is, you know, how do you evaluate how we stack up in that competition?
Yeah, obviously this comes up all the time, and I'm sure you have a lot of thoughts about this as well. I'll go back and forth. I think that Republicans have done a very good job, given how little they have to work with. I think they are able to, for the most part, and again, particularly even in this presidency, punch one short, simplistic message. I mean, you can mock the hell out of something like Herman Cain 999, you know, or build the wall, crime will fall. But most people pay attention to politics the way that I pay attention to most sports, which is to say that if there's something like really big that happens, enough so that it's actually come off the sports pages and into my world somehow, then sure, I'll have heard about it. What do I think about said event is probably influenced by something I heard from a friend or family member, or just, you know, half a headline that I scanned somewhere, like half of it, right? And so, again, understanding that that is the way in which you're operating, it has to usually be simplistic. Sure, again, for like a primary audience that is going to get deep into it, or people like my mom who were pretty disinterested voters before and now like watch Rachel Maddow every night religiously. I mean, who's been like radicalized by the Trump administration, homegrown. For those people, sure, there's something different. But again, for, you know, the masses who aren't paying attention as much, it's understanding, you know, what you have to work with.
I have a neighbor who constantly, when he talks to me about politics, feels that Democrats don't work with emotion
yes.
when they're campaigning, and that we are too wonky, mm-hmm. and that we can't reach the sort of voters you're talking about because
yeah.
of that. Do you agree with that?
I do. This is something that I, when I do media trainings, that I try to teach as well, which is that you're going to do much better if you tell a story, paint a picture, than if you try to convince us with facts and figures or a laundry list of policy items. It's just not how people connect. They connect.
Maybe some people do.
Maybe some people do.
But not the vast mass of people that you're trying to swing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's frustrating to people who operate in a world of policy and, mm-hmm. right?
There's a reason that they're doing the policy, right?
Well, what skills do you think make a good political communicator?
I think it's somebody who is rabidly interested in the news, and someone who understands why a particular story is getting attention versus another story. I mean, you know, if you look at like the front page of your newspaper, right, you'll see that there's a mix of hard news and soft news. Like, it's going to be a combination of, you know, let's say foreign policy or domestic policy and, you know, a cat story. And that's because they've learned, right, that this is, human interest is broad and varied. And so it is someone who gets those kind of concepts, right, who gets, like, not just who's interested in the news, but also gets how news works. I think it's somebody who can come across, sounds amazing, but who can meet people where they are in a way that doesn't turn people off. I think you have to be a storyteller too. Those would be my three things.
Is that kind of a personality type, or can that be learned?
I think it can be learned. I would never have told you that I was an extrovert. And I think still, if I do like a Myers-Briggs test, I'm probably like somewhere, I'm in the middle of like introvert, extrovert. So the idea that, you know, I'd have to like make 100 cold calls or whatever to try to get a reporter interested in a story that I was trying to tell was horrifying to me when I first started out. And it's not necessarily the way that it works now either, but I'm also competitive. And so I wanted to get better.
If you look at strong political communicators, are there a few that you admire, that you think are great at it in this at this moment?
Oh, in this moment is interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, this isn't in this moment at all. It was just the story that came to mind was someone who I absolutely disagree with on almost everything, but was when Ari Fleischer became the White House press secretary. In one of the first White House press briefings that he did, maybe the first one that he did, they asked him a soft news question, which was, is this your dream job? And he said, no, my dream job is to be the shortstop for the Yankees. This is a pretty good job, right? But that's humanizing, right? That's funny. It's humanizing.
It's quotable.
It's quotable. It's great, right? So again, when there were sort of those
moments. But his
moments,
pivot wasn't quick enough.
I don't know. I mean, you know, another one that I think about in the same way was sort of in the last months of the Clinton administration. Again, another sort of soft news question that was asked of, I believe it was Jake Seward, was the press secretary at the time. And they asked him, so in, you know, President Clinton's presidency, he's been to 49 states that he's visited. He has not been to Nebraska in, you know, these waning days of the administration. Have you scheduled time for him to go to Nebraska? And he said, we are constantly seeking ways to get to Nebraska, right? You know, sort of again, like if you could take the moment, make a quick joke of it and diffuse it, right? And then pivot to something harder. I think the people who are able to do that, people again, who are able to sort of, you know, bring in sort of hard and soft, who can take things that are outside of politics, you know, the people who are, and I'm not good at this, by the way, but are sort of able to kind of, you know, make the pop culture, you know, reference to the political thing. Again, you're able to bring in people except, you know, outside of those hardcore guys that are going to live and breathe the policy.
So what's your pitch exactly when you're looking at a client? Supposing I say, I have a political podcast, I want a story written about it. What do you tell me?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing that I do is I listen to your story and try to figure out just, first of all, what I think is interesting about it. And the things that I look for are all the things that we've talked about in this hour. What about your story or your background fits well into larger conversations that we're having right now? And then I think about who would be most interested in writing about that, talking about that, and in what ways.
Is our president a good political communicator?
I think he understands some things very well. One of the things that he understands very well is that, you know, scattered attention, mindset, what do you do to break through? Being willing to be a bomb thrower is something that, you know, that works. There's got to be a point of diminishing returns. But for a long time, it works. So in those ways, sure, I think he's good. In a lot of other ways, you know, you can fool some of the people some of the time, right? Or fool all the people some of the time.
Or some of the people all the time.
And some of the people all the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. It only gets him so far. And I think we're coming up to the, you know, the limits of how.
And you probably wouldn't coach one of your clients to lie constantly.
I certainly would not. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest things that when, for some reason, you know, if you're looking at a campaign, like the rest of the campaign or an organization, everybody that's not communications seems to think that there's some voodoo magic to what we do. And there's really not at all. It's just, you know, you're never going to lie. You're never even going to tell part of the truth. You might have a way of telling it that is more sympathetic than another way. And you can work around the edges there. But no, of course you're never going to lie. And they do malpractice to this profession when, you know, Sean Spicer gets up there and says this was, you know, the biggest inauguration audience in history, period. I mean, that is absolute malpractice and sours people on what actually this job should be.
And kind of boomeranged on him pretty good.
Sure did. Yeah. He has not really been able to recover, it seems.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you today. Anything else you want to say?
Just that I'm really delighted that we made this connection. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your time.
Bye. That was Christy Setzer. He's at newheightscommunications.com. Glad to have Christy on our team. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.